Welcome back to Mirage Profiles. My name is Tim. And now I'm talking to Hannes. Hello, Hannes.
Hello, Tim.
So we two know each other for a long time, and you kind of brought me here. But I'm going to ask you more or less the same questions I am asking all the others before. But first of all, well, how should we start? Well, we are in Marrakesh right now. We are at a very specific, special place. What can you tell us about this place?
This place is a hostel, the Priscilla, the Queen of the Medina, and is run by two of my friends, whom I met several years ago when I was on the beach in southern Morocco, in Mirleft. Mm-hmm. And I met there Hanna, who's half Moroccan and half German. So I talked to her, and she had back then only a car and has had as next project to have an artist residency and a guest house in Marrakesh.
But didn't exist yet.
It didn't exist yet.
Okay.
She basically used the big car she had and sold it as a base for getting the hostel started.
Mm-hmm. And when did you decide to use this as a venue?
That was back in 2014 when I was in Mirleft, when I met Hannah. And back then I was also actually working on this whole project, so I implemented the transport layer security stack for Mirage OS there in Mirleft at the beach. And I was always interested in small conferences and small venues and small events where everybody needs to or will at the end talk to each other. And then in 2016, so last year, I had the idea to actually have a community event for Mirage OS for the people. And doing an event like that, which spanned back then, I thought maybe 20, 30 people, some of my friends, some people from Cambridge who were involved in the project earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Then I thought, why not try Marrakesh? Why not try Morocco? Because it's relatively cheap, pretty fast to get here from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only 4 to 5 hours by plane. And having a similar event in Europe would be much harder to get and much more expensive. And I just also love the cuisine they have here in Marrakesh.
And of course, there's the option of doing this in December and still have good weather.
Yes, I mean,
that's an amazing feature.
I initially did that last year in March, around my birthday. That was also a motivating factor.
Mm-hmm.
And March in the United Kingdom is very, very rainy and very gray. And I wanted to have some change.
So I would say this was a good idea. also, not only from experiencing it myself, but also talking to other people here before, both in this podcast and outside of it. Let's look a bit at why you are in this community. Maybe talk about a bit how you started programming. What brought you into programming?
Well, programming I actually learned at school. I learned Turbo Pascal back then, or Pascal. And later I also learned various more levels of Turbo Pascal, but then I reminded my computer teacher that Turbo Pascal is at some point boring and he should teach us something new. And he was a bit into functional programming, and I actually learned my first steps in Haskell from him.
Really?
In school.
Wow.
And we also learned a bit about databases like MySQL and BitPerl. But I was basically stuck with this Pascal, and then after school I learned various other languages which I thought would be important to know. And then I ended, thanks to you, Tim, on a on a ride from Chemnitz, formerly Karl Marxstadt, from the Chemnitzer Linux Tage back to Berlin, where you had a broken arm and I drove the car.
Oh.
Where we talked at length about goodness of Dylan, the dynamic language. And after our intense talk, I actually started to develop Dylan again together with Andreas Book.
That I didn't know I was responsible for this.
Yeah, yeah. That was back in 2003 or 4, something like that, mm-hmm. when we drove back. Then in 2005, I actually attended together with Andreas this ICFP programming contest.
Oh, yeah, you did that.
And that was really my motivation to go into academia, because we were invited to the International Conference on Functional Programming
mm-hmm.
in Tallinn in Estonia.
You won a prize, right?
We won the second prize and the judges' prize. And the judges' prize in that scenario, so it was a bit different than the other years. There was up front a 72-hour contest. Then they waited 2 weeks and refined the problem and gave another 24 hours to mm-hmm. redevelop. And they found our code changes and the refactoring you needed to do between the first and the second episode. They were very clean and very very nice to read. But yeah, then I got a bit dragged into academia and had this idea to develop more formally verified systems during my PhD in Copenhagen. There I wrote a lot of Scala code and a lot of Coq code. Coq is a proof assistant, where you basically express in a logic the theorems and the invariants you want to verify. And then you can actually verify those theorems, but you can also export that whole code fragment to, for example, OCaml or Haskell or whatever.
So you basically create the program that is proven to work right?
Yes, you write the program in a proof system and verify the theorems, and then you export and generate the program.
Is that good code?
That is pretty decent. I mean, on a technology level. But for verifying a data structure in Java, written in Java with 150 lines of data structure code, we needed roughly 5,000 lines proof script. I came to the conclusion that it is not the case that we will be able to take off-the-shelf existing software, write some theorems and some specification for it, and just prove it correct. That will not happen. Instead, what you do is you take some off-the-shelf software, you simplify it, you think hard about it, you think a bit more about it. You remove another few bits and pieces from the implementation, which are too complicated. Then you try to minimize the shared mutable state inside of the implementation, because that's really hard to verify, because everybody has access to this piece of memory and can just mutate it. So you have to take care that other pieces of the code don't do that while you are executing.
Side effects,
yes. So after my PhD, I actually didn't really know what to do, because I thought, formal verification is nice and I want to get there, but I won't be able to implement an operating system, a verified one, until I die. So what to do now? I have to also admit that before my PhD, I worked also on network protocols in Dylan. So I wrote also together with Andreas Burg a full TCP/IP implementation, including a graphical user interface, which is similar to Wireshark, which is a network sniffer. And so I have a broad interest in actual real-world protocols and how to implement them in a nice shape so that I can maybe verify them. And then, after my PhD, I was first a bit unemployed, which is always a very nice time to sort myself. And that was, in the middle of 2013, I graduated. And in 2014, I then spent the spring or the winter and spring in Morocco. And just before that, a friend of mine reminded me at the CCC Congress that we should implement a purely functional version of some onion routing, because working in that privacy and security area with insecure program languages like C and write systems code for that is very harmful because there are too many bugs in that. I told him, yeah, well, onion routing. I've looked into that before. So what we need is a TLS connection. In order to set up a TLS connection, we need X509 certificates, which are encoded in ASIN1, which is a abstract syntax notation version 1, which is a meta language used mainly in the telecommunication industry. But it's just a tech language value format in binary and so on. So it's a pretty nice format, but pretty hard to implement because you can obviously write an ad hoc parser for a certificate, but it will never really work and can get properly extended if you don't implement all of the steps. And ASN1 parsers, well, or X509 certificate parsers in various TLS implementations are very brittle because they use a lot of mutable state to find out at which nesting level they are and so on. Mm-hmm. And there is a long history of vulnerabilities in these. So I told my friend David from Croatia, I told him at the CCC, yeah, we need all of that. And the leaf element we need is ASN1. And ASN1 is something I wasn't willing to touch at that point in time. And he told me about this Mirage thing, the Mirage operating system, where they, I believe, just released version 2.0 or so at the end of 2013. So I went off to Morocco, did some recreational programming, actually using some JavaScript and Dylan back then. And
so that was the first time you encountered OCaml.
Well, I was aware of OCaml before because using Cock is written in OCaml. Mm-hmm. And other pieces during my studying, I encountered OCaml various times. Okay. But I haven't really written a big program more than the Fibonacci numbers or a Hello World in it. And then, yeah, in 2014, at the end of January, I get a chat message from David, who told me, oh, here, by the way, ASN1 Combinators, it is working. And he wrote within those 4 weeks fully generic ASN1 parser and applied the X509 grammar to it, and it was just working. Mm-hmm. And I told him in the chat, yeah, where are you now? You're in Zagreb, it's below zero. Oh, you have to book a flight. You have to come to Morocco. We will finish this TLS within the next month. And so it was. So it came. I learned a lot.
He came down to Morocco.
He came down to Morocco, booked a horrible flight with a long layover in London. But yeah, and then we started to design and implement TLS. But I learned a lot from David, who has a long experience in writing purely functional Haskell code, mm-hmm. and used a lot of this core Haskell programming and applied it to OCaml. Because he's actually more a Haskell person than a OCaml person. Mm-hmm. But he's happy to work in this purely functional subset. So we are not using any exceptions or mutable state in the core, which is important to be able to reason about the code in a very local fashion.
So on top of this, you put the TLS encryption together with the certificate stuff, which is somehow necessary. And glued it together with the already existing networking code of Mirage.
Yes.
And there it was. And then you told Anil and he was surprised. That's what he told me.
Yes, that was it more or less. So TLS, the protocol itself, that is what I implemented mainly. And David helped me then to redesign it. And now we have a proper pipeline and it's actually a pretty readable code. well, it's still, I'm not proud of it. I should refactor it once more because it's not yet finished. But David could...
Does it cover the most recent developments of TLS?
Yes, so there's also a branch for TLS 1.3.
Mm-hmm.
So we are feature complete, basically. We don't support any elliptic curves in the cryptography because we don't have them implemented. Yeah, and David took mostly care about ASN1 and X509, and once that was done, also about the crypto primitives and interfacing them and have a nice and high-performance crypto subsystem. And I did more of the X509 validation work and the protocol logic, the implementation of the protocol logic.
So it all came together in... In the desert where the camels are.
Yes, in Mialef in southern Morocco. And then I also picked up of doing some marketing. So I did the marketing for the project. I showed up on IRC and talked actually on IRC with Anil. And I was also amazed. It was the first professor or the first faculty staff whom I was able to chat on IRC with, which is not very common in the academic community.
Still, yes.
And then I lots of TLS flaws happened, like Apple's go to fail back then, and OpenSSL's Heartbleed, and so on. And that were great opportunities for me to brag about our new TLS stack on Twitter. And that got picked up and got some interest.
By who?
By random people and friends of mine on the internet, so random hackers. I'm also active in the KS Communication, KS Computer Club in Germany, bunch of hackers. And it was well perceived. And Anil was also very happy about that and immediately invited us for a week in Cambridge in April to talk with them and show our results and so on.
But at that time you have already worked in Cambridge, right?
No.
That was just like after this. Oh, yeah, we were in Denmark before, right? Okay.
Yeah, I was in Denmark, then I was in Mialef, Morocco, unemployed but working on TLS, and then in the summer we finally got employment.
For this ML work?
Well, at University of Cambridge and for doing TLS work, because TLS stack wasn't finished back then.
So you gave a presentation on the future or the current state of Mirage OS. What would be the most important things to restate probably here? What do you think the project stands and what do you think the project should move to and could move to?
Yeah, so I'm very happy with the project. I'm also very happy with my involvement. I've been... trying to create a community of Mirage OS, and that is also what I try here. So I have a small event where I think people who are valuable inside of the community, who are not in there yet but who are very nice people and can contribute much, I just invited them here. And Mirage OS, as of now, from a technical perspective, I think it is good for basic internet services. So we can actually run and deploy already some of the smaller things. Like I run my website and my weblog and various other websites and DNS service with Mirage OS. And it could improve in the documentation and also in the number of useful applications which can be deployed.
And that's what works.
But it works. I run it since more than 2.5 years live on the internet.
Must be a good feeling to know that your own website is being delivered by your very own crypto somehow, <Yes. laughs> based on a foundation that is not, you know, suspicious to fail on the first stumbling block that comes along the internet.
Yeah, that is very interesting that you mentioned that here, because the longest running unicornal I have is really the Bitcoin Piñata.
Oh.
So that is...
yes, I heard about that. That's so cool. So who set that up? You did.
Well, so well, it's as always complicated. It was David's idea to set something like that up.
So explain what it is.
So it is a transparent and self-serving security bait.
So basically it's a system, a Hack Me system on the internet that is available on the net. You can connect to it, you can talk to it, it serves a website basically saying, hi, I'm a system on the internet, hack me, if you get inside me, there's a private key for 10 bitcoins.
Yes, there's a private key for a wallet which contains 10 bitcoins. So the transparency comes...
As we speak, this is $100,000.
Oh, wow.
Or
I'm
even
rich now.
I think it's 120,000 as we speak, actually. It just went up again.
Okay. That's interesting.
That's something.
I don't really care too much about cryptocurrencies. I think it's a waste.
That doesn't matter, but
it's
a real
waste of energy,
you know.
And I want to have that on tape. They are responsible for the climate change.
Well, increasingly, yes. It's definitely not the only cause.
But okay, so we have a TLS stack. How do you do marketing for a TLS stack? That was the main question which was in the room. And how do you convince people to actually look at that project?
Money.
So David's idea was to have, oh yeah, well, other companies have security baits, and you can, if you find a vulnerability, you can get them to pay you some money. And he said, oh yeah, we can do that. We can automate that. And transparency is given by just having the blockchain hooked up. So as soon as someone gets access to the private key, they can just transfer the money. And we will see that in the blockchain, that someone had access to the money. And now about the sleeping well or not. So the first 2 days after I set up this Bitcoin Pinata and actually filled it with the real secret key and have it live and online on the internet, I couldn't sleep for more than 1 hour. I always had to check the blockchain.
Have you seen actual attacks on this system?
Yes. So I'm very bad at monitoring. I'm really bad at monitoring, especially for something that works. But for a Usenet security paper, which we had published in 2015, that was also one of the reasons to have a Bitcoin Pinata to show off in a paper, a small paragraph in a paper. For that, we had then 3 months of Bitcoin Pinata, and we actually gathered the statistics and analyzed it a bit. And there were more than 40,000 accesses to it and attempts to do it. A lot of automated tools which find flaws like Heartbleed, but we weren't vulnerable to Heartbleed. So we also took, while developing the TLS stack, we looked into a lot of literature and tried to find what are the common exploits against TLS implementations. So what are the errors we need to avoid? And there were quite a few of them.
And you already avoided them at that time? Or
yes.
Okay.
So we still have no recipe for getting rid of timing side channels in the... in the asymmetric encryption, we can do that, but in CBC, together with the hashing in TLS, we don't really have a recipe. But it seems like... So a student in San Jose actually tried that out on our TLS stack. The attack is named Lucky 13, because you have to be lucky. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like he can get any timing data out of the stack. But I'm still sure that under some conditions you will be able to do that, but it's likely not relevant in the practice.
So what do you think where Mirage OS is heading or could be developed into? What is it for? What can it be? What should it be?
So Mirage OS itself is not really well defined what it is. So it's a base layer for an operating system, providing so far network access, so network protocols. Persistent storage is nowadays pretty new, but it seems to work. I haven't tested it myself, mutable persistent storage. And apart from that, you have business logic, or protocol logic, which is implemented there. So you can really use it as something, as anything which on deployment basis where you have hypervisor technology or virtualization technology.
Yeah, but, you know, well, this is basically true for everything else too, you know.
Yes.
Where does it excel? Where is it? What could be the killer app?
I don't know, to be honest.
Yeah,
what
sure.
could be the killer app? What I want to...
If we would know that, it would already exist.
Yes.
But, you know, somehow, I mean,
what
it
I'm
is small, it is secure.
It is small, it
purely functional.
It's boots fast, and it is, functional. It is nice to read most of the code.
So
and it has a very small memory footprint, and it in general has a very small trusted computing base. So it has a very small the amount of code is very small, which is actually executed and which you need to trust in order to trust the whole system.
Recent reports on parts of Minix being part of Intel CPUs and other layers that are sort of wrapped up in the hardware that have control on a hypervisor level or other levels. Do you see Mirage OS being positioned in a way that, that doesn't matter?
I do think it matters, and I would hope that Mirage OS would mainly be used for the good. For good systems, and my own vision is to.
Do you think a Mirage system, Mirage-based system, could be endangered by such subsystems?
Endangered?
Yeah.
You mean like?
If let's say there's some exploit.
Yeah.
For this code in the CPU itself.
Yes.
Is there any kind of resilience built into Mirage?
No, there can't be any resilience inside of Mirage because it is based on the actual CPU. So we trust the hardware and the CPU and also the underlying hypervisor. So I can think of a future where instead of having an Intel CPU or so... more open CPU like RISC-V is used instead, and then the trusted base is actually easier to understand and easier to follow because it's open.
Yeah, and I think here such small systems also have the advantage not only being small but also not having a lot of overhead, so they can provide some significant performance even on hardware that's not totally optimized to like the latest and greatest.
Mm-hmm.
So you still have enough headroom to, you know, perform the usual crypto tasks even in a multi client situation. But, you know, you still rely on open and cheap hardware.
Yes. Yeah, I don't think that if you don't trust the hardware that you can execute any private information, because if the CPU is broken or if the CPU is untrusted, you don't
there's
have...
There's not much you can do.
Yeah, there's just game over.
So, who should be interested in Mirage OS? Who is it for? I mean, I think there are, I'm not only talking about the usage or the like the killer app, like in terms of programmers. Who should be interested in this?
I think so. Mirage OS takes a really radical approach towards systems code and systems design because instead of trying to adapt to a Unix system or trying to pretend to be a Unix system, we throw away all the common assumptions and everything you have in a Unix system. We just throw that away and start from scratch, trying to reduce all of the code, all we can do. So we don't have multiple processes. because we are inside of a virtual machine, so there's already in the hypervisor something which schedules the virtual machines. So we just rely on someone being responsible for scheduling the virtual machines. And every virtual machine, so every Mirage OS unikernel, is actually there for exactly one service. So we don't need to have multiple processes inside of Mirage OS unikernel. And we can just get rid of the entire complexity of having a scheduler around, which is a busy loop, which needs to do whatever, and then maybe some preemption and so on. And Mirage OS also doesn't provide you with any preemption, so it's a cooperative multitask system. This means that you can rely on code blocks between binds which execute in order and always from beginning to end, and you don't have any re-entrant problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so systems programmers who are interested in a new feature, new future, and the redesign of the current systems or of the currently used general purpose operating systems.
It should have a look at Mirage OS. It should have a look at OCaml.
Yes, at Mirage OS.
Do you think other programming environments could learn from Mirage OS? I mean, OCaml is probably not the only language that you can do this in.
Yes, and there are various unikernel projects ongoing. There's a similar one which is written in Haskell, but it's mainly written by one or two people over in the States.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is there are also various other unikernel projects. Another one is in C++. It's written in C++. But in my opinion, that is then you are losing some of the safety guarantees which you can have with OCaml. And OCaml is also a very nice language for writing unikernels in, because it has a module system which you can program. So it's basically another stage of programming. And inside of that module system, we encode devices and so on. So you can have the very same Mirage OS application, which you, on the one side, compile to Unix with the socket stack, so with the Unix socket stack, which runs DNS server or web server. Or you can use the Mirage tool to configure and compile it down to a KVM machine running on ARM64.
Where there's no host operating system around.
Where there's still
the KVM, but
hypervisor
mm-hmm.
around. So with but KVM, there's still a hypervisor in the Linux and the host system around.
But it could run on the bare metal too.
Yes, if we would have actual device drivers, it could run on the bare metal too.
Okay, that's missing. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, writing device drivers is painful and a lot of work. And I don't think we have the amount of resources to do that at the moment.
At the moment?
It would be very nice to have, for example, a Raspberry Pi or so as a single backend, which we actually support, and develop the device drivers for Raspberry Pi. That would be a very, very neat platform, in my opinion.
All right. Okay, Hannes, I think we can wrap it up. Thanks for contributing to the community and to this podcast. And we say goodbye.
Goodbye.